Good. I'd like to thank the organizers here for having me back for another update on Axions. I had the great privilege 4 years ago of being asked to give an update at Neutrino 2000. There we are on the left having lunch in the snow control room watching the event display. It was actually one of the most memorable experiences of my life, going down into the mine and watching the beautiful experiment that they had put together and was already working. It's a very memorable event. What I'm going to do in this talk is talk about two major efforts going on. There are a couple of experiments in the world, one in the U.S. and one in Japan, which are looking for extremely light axions. In the range of a microelectron volt to a millielectron volt, which may constitute the dark matter of our universe, and remarkable experiment going on at CERN, the CAST experiment, which is looking for axions which are probably much heavier, on the order of an electron volt or so. But the key thing here is what they have done for the first time has been to establish a limit, or will shortly establish an observational limit below broadband in mass, below that based on inferences of stellar evolution. And it's quite a remarkable and a very clever experiment. Okay, just a brief review of the axion. Particle physics provided three candidates for dark matter neutrinos, which are likely too light to constitute the dark matter and have other difficulties as well. Supersymmetry it gives rise to the neutralino we'll hear about, and the strong CP problem, why the neutron electric dipole moment is vanishingly small, why CP symmetry gratuitously is conserved, the Peche-Quinn mechanism gives rise to the axion. I'm not going to go through a detailed review here, but what you should think about is that the axion is just a very light cousin of the pi zero. It's a pseudoscalar. Its couplings and its mass both go inverse to some large undetermined energy scale, the Peche-Quinn symmetry breaking scale. It's really the only knob, the only free parameter in the theory. For purposes of this talk, phenomenologically, all one has to know is that as the mass goes down, the couplings all go down proportionately. Now, why the axion is relevant to the dark matter problem is that very roughly the primordial abundance when axions were created at the QCD time, about 100 nanoseconds after the Big Bang, in a phase transition, they were never in thermal equilibrium with everything, the total abundance goes roughly inversely to the mass. So the lighter the axion is, the more axions contribute to the matter density of the universe. And the lower bound for the axion mass comes from the fact that we know that axions that do not overclose the universe. In fact, matter we now know is only about a quarter of omega equals unity. And then on the upper end, starting from reactor and accelerator experiments and then down into a seamless cloth of stellar evolution limits, there's supernova 1987A, which if the axion were heavier than about a millielectron volt, would have screwed up the concordance between the observation and the model of a very long 10-second neutrino pulse coming out of that the proto-neutron star core. Now, you might think looking for an axion is a fool's errand because the basic cross sections are just abysmally weak. In fact, they are they are weaker compared to the weak interaction scale, as the weak interaction scale is the atomic scattering cross-section scale. So at first you might think this is a hopeless enterprise. However, over the years, 25 years or more since the Peche-Quinn Weinberg-Wilczek axion came to be, a number of studies of how to look for this. The most promising of them all rely on the axion coupling to two photons, and in particular, the axion's ability to, as a pseudoscalar, to scatter off an external electromagnetic field and convert into a single photon which carries the entire energy, the mass plus the kinetic energy of the axion. And conversely, a photon through a transverse magnetic field can become a beam of axions as well. Now, at first blush, you might say, well, if axions are the dark matter and they clump around halos, galactic halos and clusters, this might be very easy. You simply would look out there with a radio telescope and look for an unidentified sharp line, just like looking for a 511 line from an annihilation of positronium or a photon of half the pi zero mass. It turns out that doesn't work because the lifetime goes down like mass to the fifth from the pion mass, and it's just irrelevantly long. On the other hand, what Pierre Secchi realized many years ago in his paper, 1983, was that one could do an experiment with three ingredients. One is a very strong magnetic field. The second is a tunable microwave cavity of very high Q number that's tunable, which allows you to step tune and within the bandpass of the cavity look for the resonant conversion of axions into photons. And then third would be a state-of-the-art ultra-low noise microwave receiver. And from here on out, it's just a radio exquisitely built. One mixes down and then to the frequency of the bandpass of the cavity, and then takes the power spectrum through a fast Fourier transform to look for the peak, and then one steps away. Okay, so this is what one would see. One would see the black body plus the noise plus the intrinsic noise of the amplifier, and then look for a very, very small signal of finite width, small but finite width, as one tunes the cavity, the base of which is the axion mass, and then it's smeared upwards by about 1 part in 10 to the 6, which is just beta of 0.3 for virialized things inside our galaxy, beta of 0.3 squared. This is just the kinetic motion of the axions in there. And there may be, as a number of authors have pointed over to the past decade, fine structure due to axions that are still falling in for the first time or only making their first few radial oscillations across the galaxy that have not been thermalized, which are extremely narrow because the axions were created as a zero-temperature Bose gas in the early universe and were never thermalized. This would be rich in information. You should really hope that axions are the dark matter because these things will move around, will dance around with their Doppler shift as the Earth spins and rotates, spins on its axis and rotates around the Sun. Time permitting, and if popular opinion demanding, at the end of the talk, I'll actually show a movie, a little simulation of one infall model folded with the proper velocity of the laboratory on the Earth's frame, and to show you the kind of information that comes out. Okay, the good news from the point of view of axions from dark matter is that the parameter space is bounded, as mentioned, in mass over about three decades in mass. It's also in explorations of many different axion models of very, very different standpoints, seems to be bounded in the axion photon coupling to less than about a factor of 100 in power. The bad news is, of course, that power tends to be very small. In the experiment I'm about to show you, it's six orders of magnitude smaller than the radio transmitter, the signal we pick up on Earth, for this thing that was launched 30 years ago and is beyond the orbit of Pluto right now, and by the way, whose frequency you know because you built it. Here we have to step tune from hundreds of megahertz to hundreds of gigahertz, ultimately in very fine steps, not devoting too much time to doing that. I will pick out as sort of goalposts two models. In fact, the generation experiment we're working on now and has been taking data for 9 years is one particular model cutting halfway down this ribbon. We have a path to an upgrade, which is now funded and beginning, to go to quantum limited squid amplifiers, which will handily get us down to below this band and allow us to sweep up much faster in frequency. Okay, this is a classic signal-to-noise problem. There's only three things that you can do. You can either increase the signal, decrease the noise, or integrate longer. Because of the fact that one has to step tune the cavity, one really cannot dedicate more than about 1,000 seconds or 100 seconds per frequency interval. You can contemplate building a bigger, stronger magnet, but one could spend millions of dollars making only factors of two improvement. Where you really want to invest is in improving the total system noise here. At present, the system noise is about 3 Kelvin, and with the amplifiers I will show you later on, one should be able to make a factor of 30 to 50 improvement in that. So just some pictures here. This is the magnet. It's about 12 tons. It's about a 6-ton coil, 1.1 meters by 60 centimeters. Clear bore there on the bottom. Here's the experimental insert. Under the vacuum shroud here is this copper cavity with the tuning rods. It's dropped down in, cooled, and away you go. Let me point out, to my knowledge, this is the quietest radio receiver ever made. In fact, out to integration periods of 1 month, the noise still falls like 1/(√ of time, which means that in principle, if you sat at one frequency, if you were given knowledge where the axion sat, or when the day comes that this becomes a junior lab experiment, you'd be able to detect a signal which constituted only one additional RF photon per minute on top of the black body plus the black body plus electronic noise of the amplifier. So it's an exceedingly good receiver that's been built. Just some data, the co-added spectra. Here's a little signal which ultimately turns out to be a clinker. This is an environmental signal. It's an episodic radio signal which has crept into the doer and back up the receiver chain. This looks much more like the real thing. That would be a threshold candidate there. I'm not going to go through the details of the whole procedure, but what you're looking at is Gaussian noise to many, many sigma. And one just does a hierarchy of cuts and then rescans of surviving candidates till you get to the point of a handful of candidates which persist, and you have to look at individually and identify either as being the real thing or as a radio signal or interference from external environmental noise. The beauty of this experiment is that you have a way of turning off the signal, which is something I think our WIMP colleagues would dearly love to have. Here you could simply turn off the magnetic field and ramp the field up and down, and the signal has to go up and down like B squared. So you have a way of a silver bullet test, ultimately, if you find a persistent candidate which doesn't go away. To show you that we've done the job and we've been doing it for several years, here's data taken over approximately an octave, showing that the experiment we built and ran to get to this one particular model is in fact on target. Alternatively, one can analyze the data by freezing or picking a particular model. This is how it was sold and published to our astrophysics colleagues in APJ Letters, by freezing the model and then doing a determination of the halo density, which is excluded over this mass range for this particular model. We've just done an analysis, a high-resolution analysis, which will be completed and published in a few months. Here's our future. It seems like the Department of Energy has finally approved and funded this. Our collaborators at Berkeley, John Clark, one of the premier quantum electronics guys in the world, and our postdoc apprentice to him, have actually now developed amplifiers, SQUID amplifiers, which are now within a factor of 30% of the quantum limit. And now this has become a hot ticket in the quantum information quantum computing world, in addition to its application here to axion experiments. This is the ideal thing to read out a single electron transistor for these new schemes for quantum computing. Just a word here on our Japanese colleagues, Seishi Matsuki. They're using a very different technique. The front end is exactly the same. The back end is now, instead of being a classical amplifier, is now a Rydberg atom scheme, and what one really does is to laser pump an atomic beam going through the detection cavity here, prepares a state, tunes by Zeeman splitting a 2p to 1s orbital such that any photons which are created can be absorbed with high efficiency to an unoccupied state. The atomic beam flies out through a parallel plate geometry, which adds a linear potential, and then all the atoms which have been promoted to this upper state will just simply be sucked out into a channeltron like this. So what this has really created, and this goes back to concept goes back to Kleppner and Gallagher and others 30, 40 years ago, is basically a photomultiplier tube for single RF photons. It's a really beautiful technique. And so far, it's been a hammer looking for a nail for many years. And now this group here has been implementing it on their version of the experiment. Let me pass now to acknowledge Juan Cuellar and Igor Erostratha from the CAST collaboration, provided us with some very nice graphics here of a different concept here, which is to look for axions coming from the sun, axions created, and again, in a Primakov interaction in the sun within about a tenth of the solar radius, and then which are detected on the Earth in a helioscope, which is a telescope, a very long transverse dipole here. And here the axion spectrum peaks at around 4 keV. Just as a benchmark, if the axion were 1 electron volt of mass, the flux at the Earth is about 10 to the 11th per square centimeter per second. So this is the master of PowerPoint here. What one wants to do is to take a very strong transverse magnetic field dipole, in this case an LHC dipole, with an X-ray detector behind it, and then look for the coherent conversion in the bore of the magnet. These are very, very relativistic axions, not axions at rest, that would fly out of the sun and then mix with the photon state and then be detected in an X-ray detector in the back. There was a first generation at Brookhaven, just a warm magnet propped up, pointed at where the sun was going to go down with an X-ray detector behind it, and then they went for coffee, came back and published a paper. This was a very nice experiment. When you do something for the first time, it doesn't take a lot of work. This was a beautiful experiment done by Makoto Minowa and his collaborators in Tokyo, which was a superconducting magnet, a dry magnet by Toshiba, put on a gun mount that could actually follow the sun as it went through its orbit like that, and which made a very big improvement. But then our colleagues here at CERN and the full collaboration had their eyes on a prototype LHC dipole. And what they have done has been to put together something that looks a little bit like William Herschel's telescopes of the 18th century, where they're kind of craned around by their snout. This is something which can track the sun for about 3 hours a day. And by the way, you can look for axions that have gone below the horizon with detectors in this end, or look for at the sun when it's up here with detectors down on the back end as well. And since you have two bores, in principle, you could have four separate detectors going. Based on an analysis they've already done with two out of their three detectors, as you see, they're right on top of the limit from horizontal branch stars, the red giant limit here. And they have data in the pocket now whose analysis within the space of a couple of months will actually get them down for the first time in a broadband way below the red giant stars. Okay, let me wrap up here. This is just a bit of a curtain call of all the limits that have been set over the years, both by stellar evolution, from Hertzian experiments, lasers shining through dipoles with a brick wall, another laser, and a photomultiplier tube. The helioscope experiment, this is an experiment Mike Turner and colleagues did, actually looking for relatively high energy axions from actual two-photon decay in the halos of rich galactic clusters. And then here in what we think is the region of interest, in the micro EV to milli EV range, as you can see, this gambit of trading bandwidth for sensitivity has really allowed us to get down halfway into the band. There's roughly the band of mass and coupling condensate. It really gets us down into the region of interest, and one can actually now troll up and with an upgrade really be able to cover this region. This is where we hope to go. I think it's realistic to think we'll be able to cover at least two-thirds of the range in mass. The concepts for the resonators become more dicey in the range from about 100 microelectron volts to a millielectron volt, but we have concepts for how to build resonators up further in mass. And our colleagues with the axion helioscope at CERN are projecting that they will, with their data that they have in hand right now, we'll be able to publish a broadband limit for the first time better than stellar evolution. And it's a real triumph. It's a beautiful experiment and very well executed. Okay, the takeaway message is here that the nice thing about this search is that the parameter space is bounded, so one can do the job. One has a goalpost there. One can do the job. We've been doing the job for several years and publishing. We're already well into the parameter space. We do have a path towards an upgrade. We have a technology which in hand, which we're going to implement in the experiment, which will allow us to go down all the way through the region of interest and troll much faster, and it's going to enable a definitive experiment. On the solar axion side, the original motivation came from what was thought to be a possible gap in what otherwise was a fairly seamless cloth of stellar evolution limits around 1 eV. Probably it's closed, but one should really look at this, at the real importance of this, and that is that it is for the first time done in an observational way, a limits better than very robust stellar evolution limits, and this is a real triumph of this collaboration, and one should be open for surprises that something may indeed be seen. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Comments and questions for the speaker, please.
There are also Kaluza-Klein models with axion. Can you comment on this, please, about their search?
About the
Kaluza-Klein axions, models with Kaluza-Klein axions, not
directly. Thank you. Yeah. Some years ago, two or three years ago, there, of course, were these papers published based on large extra dimensions giving rise to axions. A lot of my smart friends, including Georg Grafelt and Mike Turner here, have tried to understand this. They produce, in fact, not a single axion state, but a whole ladder, almost a picket fence of them. And it's a little difficult to understand. I understand that there are, for the first time, papers being written about the cosmological implications of them. Is the strength divided over this infinite number of axions or not? There have been some proposals put forward to look for them. But until I think we understand a little bit better what the cosmological implications are and what we should be looking for, it's very difficult to design a serious experiment. And maybe I'd pass the ball here to Georg or Mike on that for more expert commentary. They're hiding.
Okay. Nobody wants to volunteer. Oh, okay. All right, this question?
Go.
Well, go ahead.
I should let Igor explain, but as I understand, in fact, the detectors are not background free. One of them that they're just now implementing, and which is a tremendous improvement in this experiment over previous generations, is the use of a nested grazing incidents X-ray mirrors used in X-ray satellite astronomy to focus a broad aperture down onto a point where you can then obviously have a very, very small background but collect all of your signals. And I think when that's fully up and implemented, that's going to go a long way. But I think if you want the expert answer on that, I'll pass the ball to Igor. But yes, the backgrounds right now and the up to now, the dependence on the actual physical position of the telescope is something that they've had to contend with. Anyone from the cast want to comment?
No, the important thing of CAST is that it's able to measure the background of the experiment while we are not tracking the sun. We are actually only tracking the sun during the 3 hours per day, 1 hour and a half every side of the magnet. So we are able to experimentally measure the background, and then we make a subtraction of the tracking data and the background data. And as I said, the one of the detectors is profiting from this focusing device. And is the signal over background ratio for this detector is 2 orders of magnitude better than without this focusing. But the matter of the background is still there. We measure the background in non-tracking time, and then we subtract from the from the tracking data.
Okay, we have time, I think, for one or more questions. Yeah, Bernard?
What is the status of the Kyoto experiment? There are technical problems a year or two ago, but...
My understanding there is that they went through two funding cycles by Mambusho and then the agency which succeeded them after the merger. And I think they have come to the end of the second cycle. I'm not sure a renewal is possible. What they have done, which I think is a tremendous success, has been to actually show that this technique's by measuring the black body spectrum as a function of temperature on a very steep exponential curve in the range of 12 to 15 millielectron volts. And being a phaseless detector, they don't need to obey the quantum limit. They did a scan of about 10% in mass, but for whatever reason did not publish those results. By private communication, they go down considerably below KSVZ and are flirting with the DFSC limit, but in fact, those results were never published for whatever reason. But I think the thing has actually slowed down quite a bit due to the funding issue.
Okay, I think we need to move on, so let's thank the speaker again.